Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll hear from a survivor of childhood cancer. Jay Fox will also chat with experts about anti-Asian violence and GLP-1 drug side effects. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Here in Columbus, Nationwide Children's Hospital is ranked fifth in the nation for pediatric cancer care, according to U.S. News and World Report. The hospital sees as many as 13,000 inpatient and outpatient pediatric cancer patients annually. 85% of children diagnosed with cancer now survive at least 5 years after their diagnosis. A new survey finds only 42% of Americans know what pediatric cancer survivorship means. Hyundai Hope on Wheels Cancer Foundation board member Kevin Riley and 11-year-old cancer survivor Jackson Trin join us now on Columbus Perspective to explain why pediatric cancer research is so important. Good morning to you both.
Well, good morning, Jay.
Kevin, how common is pediatric cancer, and why is research so important?
Well, unfortunately, every 36 minutes, a child is diagnosed with pediatric cancer in the United States. And so, as you mentioned, although the survival rate is 85%, organizations like Hyundai Hope on Wheels are committed to driving that number up to 100% to make this a world free of pediatric cancer. And we do that by unlocking cures, and that comes through funding pediatric cancer research grants all across the nation, which we've done for 28 years now, and we'll certainly continue to keep funding those pediatric cancer research grants until no child has to hear those words, "You have cancer."
Now, I remember years ago in my career being on a mission to St. Jude's in Memphis, Tennessee, and hearing about all of the new efforts towards pediatric cancer research. This would have been, about 17 or 18 years ago. What is new today over the last 20 years that you've seen in pediatric cancer treatment and research?
Well, Jay, it's a great question. Having been around 28 years, we've seen tremendous advances in pediatric cancer treatment. And I think we find that in the area of how we treat it less invasively. So to give you some examples, HIFU and LIFU technology, so that's high-intensity focused ultrasound and low-intensity focused ultrasound, those are less invasive ways to treat pediatric cancer and allows a child that much better life after their cancer has been cured.
So how did Hyundai get involved in this deal? What's the nonprofit? How did it get started? What's the mission?
So 28 years ago, a group of Hyundai dealers decided to put an end to pediatric cancer, and we did that by founding Hyundai Hope on Wheels. So every time a Hyundai is sold, Hyundai dealers and Hyundai Motor America, we put our money together, and that money funds pediatric cancer research grants all across the nation. Now, in fact, this year we'll donate $26 million in pediatric cancer research grants, bringing our lifetime total to over $300 million. And those dollars are critically important because we fund a lot of research that's in its earlier stages, allows those researchers to take risks and explore new avenues and eventually unlock cures.
Jackson Trin is 11 years old and a cancer survivor. We welcome you now to Columbus Perspective. How are you?
I'm good.
How old were you when you were diagnosed?
I was about 7 years old when I was diagnosed.
Do you remember that time?
Yeah, it was a real scary time, but I've learned to be brave.
So, who told you that you had cancer? Did the doctor tell you or did your parents tell you?
My doctor told me. I was in the ER when it happened. I was there for many hours, but my oncologist told me. It was heartbreaking, but I made it.
What kind of cancer did you have?
I had a type of cancer called B-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia.
Did you have any idea what that was when you heard those words?
When I was 7, not at all. But my parents were crying, so I knew it was bad.
So what did it turn out to be? I mean, what is that?
So leukemia is a type of blood cancer. You have red cells that give you energy, white cells that stop you from getting sick, and platelets that stop you from bleeding or bruising easily. But my body started making some abnormal white cells, which didn't exactly do anything. So to help with that, we had to take chemo that killed those bad cells. But with it, we had to kill some good cells too, which made me tired, bleed or bruise easily, and get sick easily.
Did you go to school or were you homeschooled during your treatment?
During that whole time, I was homeschooled, and it was right after the pandemic. So I had 2 years of just homeschooling and online learning.
How old were you when you found out that you had gotten through and you were at the other side?
I was about 9 years old when I beat cancer.
Did you ring the bell?
Yeah, I rung the bell. All my doctors and nurses, everyone was there with me.
What did it feel like to beat cancer? That's a pretty big villain.
It felt amazing, and I thought about how I could help other people, which is actually how I got into Hyundai Hope on Wheels.
So what do you actually do for a Hyundai Hope on Wheels? Do you go around telling your story, or do you visit with other kids?
So I go around the country telling my story, spreading hope and awareness.
Do you ever get to visit kids in the hospital who are going through what you went through?
Yeah, I got to meet so many people, new doctors, new nurses, and kids just like me that I'm trying to help right now.
What do you say to a kid that you meet in the hospital who's just heard this diagnosis and is scared out of their mind? What do you say?
I'll tell them that everything in life is temporary. So when life is good, enjoy it. But when life is hard, just know there are better days ahead.
Jackson, you're an inspiration to all of us. We thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right. Kevin, if people want to know more about how they can participate or learn about the organization or just learn about childhood cancer in general, what's the website?
Well, they can come to HyundaiHopeOnWheels.org, and you'll learn the stories of courage and bravery, like Jackson here, Isabella, our national youth ambassadors. And I think they'll be truly inspired to, you know, try to create awareness, and then also, too, if their budget permits, actually contribute money that will go to pediatric cancer research. So, again, HyundaiHopeOnWheels.org, and we hope your listeners will go there.
All right. We want to thank Kevin Riley and Jackson Trin for being our guests today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox. Thanks for listening.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Despite limited arrests and reported assaults, there appears to be a disturbing trend toward anti-Asian verbal confrontations here in Columbus and Central Ohio. One such incident was a Bhutanese man assaulted at his home at gunpoint. In February of 2024, 27-year-old Darren Johnson was convicted of a federal hate crime after both physically and verbally assaulting an Asian student on the campus of the University of Cincinnati. Here we go. Scott Kurashige. Did I get it right?
Kurashige. Kurashige.
Okay. You are in charge of pronouncing your name permanently. He's the author of the book American Peril, and very polite and pleasant. And this is the story of the violent history of anti-Asian racism. A fascinating read. A very difficult read, a very emotional read, and he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome. We're just going to call you Scott. That's easier.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Scott, what's the difference between a hate crime and a hate incident?
Well, you know, obviously there are sadly a number of incidents that involve prejudice, bigotry, racism, and other forms of, you know, hate. But a hate crime really is something that only occurs when the law, you know, when the provisions of the law can be enforced. And hate crime laws have been something that civil rights advocates have understandably pursued, along with, of course, victims of these incidents. But they're very, very difficult to demonstrate, you know, in court, simply because it's extremely challenging to prove motivation. And so prosecutors are very, very selective in even choosing to prosecute these matters.
In talking to the Columbus Police and the Franklin County Sheriff's Office, we find that so many of these events go unreported. Why is that?
I think the first reason is that the victims often, or the survivors, oftentimes, as with the case of sexual assault, I mean, we're still learning about sexual assault cases that happened decades ago, and sometimes, obviously, we don't learn about them at all. People feel a fear of retaliation. You know, that's clearly the first reason. The second reason, which goes along with the first, is oftentimes they're not believed. They come forward and, you know, either members of the public or the authorities themselves simply say, you know, there's no proof, or it's too ambiguous, or, you know, the suspect has a different story, and it's very challenging to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that, you know, they did this. Not only that they did it, but that the motivation, again, was, you know, something like ethnic intimidation or bias as defined by the law. And I think the third thing is that in society, we just don't do enough education about people from different backgrounds to even understand why a person from a minority group may feel that they were attacked because of their identity or their background, when in fact most of our culture is geared towards the experience of the majority.
We're living in a time where if someone is different from someone else, there is fear. There may be anger. There may be accusations that are unfounded. I always like to get to the root cause of the behaviorism. In your opinion, what is the root cause of this anti-Asian racism, and what can we do about it?
Well, I think in one sense, there's a lot of reasons for, you know, members of the public to be anxious today. We're dealing with economic hardships. We're dealing with global tensions. We've just come out of, and a lot of people say we're still not out of, a terrible pandemic that took the lives of tens and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And yet at the same time, of course, so many of these tensions are rooted in bigotry, in prejudice, in stereotypes, in xenophobia. And so with anti-Asian racism, it really goes back to the 19th century. The opium wars between Britain and China, and eventually the U.S. Benefits from the unequal treaties that were established, clearly created colonial relationships between Western countries and China. And so, you know, in China, Americans and the British and other Westerners are basically above the law. They have the right to basically do whatever they want, never be prosecuted under Chinese law. For Chinese immigrants who come to the U.S. And other parts of the world, they're basically below the law. They have no chance of becoming citizens. They are originally called coolies because they're contract laborers. Even when they're so-called free laborers, they don't have the same rights that other Americans, particularly white Americans, have to, you know, be part of unions, to file discrimination cases. When Chinese immigrants are killed, as I document in the book, particularly in California after it becomes a state, they don't even have the right to testify against white people in court. So there's a case that goes up to the Supreme Court of California where a Chinese immigrant is killed by a white man, George Hall, who shoots him 15 times in the back. And he is convicted initially because the judge hears all this testimony from witnesses. But then the Supreme Court says, well, they're Chinese immigrant witnesses. And under California law, white people can never be convicted because of Asian, Native American, or black witnesses. So that's the roots in the 19th century. And then we, you know, realize that whereas the big struggles over Chinese immigration took place mainly in California and the West Coast in the 1880s, and then became a national issue. So many of these issues in the 1980s, when we have a different economic recession, are taking place in the Midwest, particularly the Rust Belt states like Michigan and Ohio.
Now, speaking of Ohio and fast forwarding 40 years plus to the current day, this is now having a very serious impact on Ohio's higher education locations. We talked about the University of Cincinnati incident in 2024. Meanwhile, at Ohio University in Athens in southeast Ohio, they now have a safe space for their Asian students because of increasing violence. Does the safe space model work? If so, can it be replicated, or are we just throwing money at the wall?
Well, I think in many cases, you know, the creation of centers for Asian American culture, for Asian American students, and particularly for the study of Asian American history, politics, and culture have made a major impact. I mean, I wouldn't be able to write my book today if there hadn't been at least some investment in research, in scholarship, in teaching on these issues. I mean, when I grew up, you know, through my K through 12 education, I learned literally next to nothing about Asian American history. I don't know if you did. Did you learn more about Asian American history than I did?
Well, I'm older than you are. So I went to Ohio State University before it had a the in the 1980s. And I took a lot of cultural awareness classes. So I did learn about Asian American history. I also learned about the women's movement. And I also learned about African American history because it was part of my history degree. But if you are not pursuing that path, the chances are it might be a footnote or an aside.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with that. I mean, because student and community activists push to add these programs, you know, we have an opportunity to take those classes in the 80s, and I was able to take them somewhat in undergrad and then particularly in graduate school. But, you know, it's only really in the past few years that there are even proposals to have these classes be part of graduation requirements for the K through 12 systems. And again, that's only in a handful of states. So for the most part, the average American really, really doesn't learn anything. And so it's been very important that these programs exist. On the other hand, you know, they are disappearing in many parts of the country.
A lot
of these programs are limited funding for them.
Right. That's the money question. How has federal anti-DEI stance affected the Asian community? Because we know it's affected the trans community. We know it's affected the LGBTQIA+ community. We know it's affected the Black community. We know it's affected the Latino community. Has it also included and affected the Asian community?
Oh, yes, definitely. The federal funding for the Asian American and Pacific Islander, you know, student support program was almost completely eliminated last year. I was actually working for one of those programs that was completely eliminated. I just read, you know, yesterday, a colleague at the University of Minnesota saying their student center for Asian American Pacific Islander students is on the chopping block right now. And so, you know, it's one thing to say that we need to go beyond identifying people on the basis of, you know, race, ethnicity, and other characteristics. I agree with that. I would like to live in the world like Dr. King, you know, dreamed of, where we can all treat each other based on the content of our character. Unfortunately, we're not at that point yet. You know, if we act like we are, then a lot of people could easily fall through the gap. But again, more importantly, with my book, I'm very interested in the conditions that people live under. But again, I think that's very much related to the type of education and learning, you know, and relationships that we build, and that requires us to be able to learn more than the perspectives of the dominant culture.
Well, and I got to ask you a question. I read something shocking in the Cincinnati Inquirer about ethnic economic exploitation and assault. And the article was about Asian restaurants reporting a large volume of fake orders causing financial strain. So basically, people would call and get an order to go and then not pick it up.
Yeah, that's really a terrible thing. And we saw during particularly the COVID-19 pandemic, I want to make clear, this was not the start of, you know, hate incidents against Asian Americans. But certainly there was a huge upsurge because so many people were being swayed by these, you know, terms like China virus and Kung flu to scapegoat not just China, but particularly Asian Americans during the COVID-19 pandemic. And we saw, you know, sometimes people might think they were pranks or they're, you know, acts of prejudice, but we also saw people violently attacked and in some cases murdered very tragically. So, you know, this is not a laughing matter, even though it may be a prank when people do that. But oftentimes it is, you know, very much done with malicious intent. Even during World War II, when Japanese Americans were put in or incarcerated, like my mother and her family, a lot of that motive was not simply, you know, rank prejudice. It was because there were farmers, there were other merchants who felt like they could profit by taking away the rights and taking away, you know, the businesses of people who were in a minority group.
Yep. Ethnic economic intimidation. Scott, you wrote the book. What do you hope the book will accomplish for the readers?
Well, I would say, you know, all of the public, again, could benefit from learning more about history. Again, I'm still learning things, even though I've been writing about this subject for over 30 years. I'm still learning things by doing the research myself. Even surveys of Asian Americans have found that less than 1 in 4 feel like they have a good grasp of Asian American history. So for Asian Americans, it's going beyond the stereotypes that many of us, you know, learn as children or even as adults and feel like, you know, we're stuck inside a box. But I would hope that, you know, particularly, you know, people who are not Asian American feel like there's a lot that they can learn. Because, again, it's not just about how we relate to each other as people. These are policy issues. So much of, you know, anti-Asian racism has stained our view of the rest of the world, as you pointed out, stains how we view, you know, global trade. Vincent Chin in the Detroit area was killed by two men who were angry that the Japanese companies were taking away, you know, U.S. auto industry jobs. Vincent Chin was a Chinese American citizen whose father, you know, served in the U.S. military. So, you know, we can misdiagnose our problems when we are not educated properly. And clearly, when we look at foreign policy and war, in so many instances, you know, we are imbibing these yellow peril stereotypes and these stereotypes rooted in Orientalism, and it prevents us from looking, you know, in a sober manner at how we as Americans need to view our foreign policy as well as our domestic policy.
The book is called American Peril: The Violent History of Anti-Asian Racism. The author, here we go, I'm going to try again, Scott Kurashige.
That's great. Yeah.
And I got it right.
The education is already moving forward. Thanks so
there
much.
You go. We want to thank Scott for being our guest. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox. Thanks for listening.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Dr. Jackie Bowen is the president of the American Optometric Association. She joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about potential eye complications that could result from the use of GLP-1 medications. Welcome, Dr. Bowen.
Thank you very much, Jake.
Boy, GLP-1 medications are super popular right now, and all over Columbus and Central Ohio, people are using them by the thousands. So what eye complications have been reported in patients on these meds?
You're absolutely right about the increased use. We estimate that 12% of Americans either are using them now or have used them sometime in their life. So, of course, with more people using them, we're noticing more results and complications. The complications with eyes and vision are certainly rare, but have increased with use of these medications. So primarily across the board, everyone is at a higher risk for an optic nerve swelling or a problem that might cause sudden loss of vision or dimming of the vision or color vision loss. People who are taking the medications because they're treating diabetes, and people who are at risk for wet macular degeneration have another set of risk factors that might be involved. So it's important to check these things out and make sure that your eye doctor is aware that you're taking the medications.
One of the things about treating diabetes is preventing the loss of eyesight. What are those complications potentially for those with diabetes or wet macular degeneration?
Sure. It's kind of a conundrum because these medications are great at helping with diabetes control and with weight management, but there's too much of a good thing sometimes, and it causes a little bit of extra leaking of blood vessels inside the eye. So in diabetes, all diabetics know that they should have an annual dilated eye exam Because we want to look at those small blood vessels in the eye. It's the easiest place in the body to look to know that what's ever happening in the eye is happening elsewhere. Macular degeneration also involves some leaking blood vessels sometimes. So the mechanism of the medication is not known exactly, but we know that we are seeing an increase in sight loss and conversion to a more advanced disease in patients who are taking GLP-1 inhibitors.
So what I'm hearing you say is that if my primary were to diagnose me with GLP-1 treatment, whether it's an injection or a pill, that I should likely make an eye exam immediately after starting to take that or before, and then go back and see that eye doctor on a regular basis after. Is that correct?
You hit the nail on the head, Jay. If you haven't had an eye exam with an optometrist in the year preceding starting the medication, make sure you get that in within a month or so after starting to take it. There are some anatomical risks in the eye that you can't detect yourself. An optometrist has to look inside and evaluate your risk for advancing to loss of vision with these things. So, yeah, after we get that baseline information, annual eye exams, for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which is monitoring your vision, are recommended.
Now, we've gotten to the point where we are so advanced technologically that we can have almost instantaneous communication with our primary care providers through services like MyChart and others like that. Does that kind of a service allow an eye doctor to communicate with a primary so that they are in concert on the treatment?
Absolutely. Doctors of optometry have a mechanism of being on call 24/7, just like other medical doctors. So we are able to assess, even over the phone by calling the office, the urgency and the need for an appointment. And then we absolutely communicate with the prescriber of that medication and talk about, you know, ways that we might mediate the risk for loss of vision.
Sometimes when we think things are wrong, they're not actually wrong. And sometimes we think, oh, it's no big deal, and it turns out to be a really big deal. What symptoms should we be looking for to talk to both our optometrist and also our primary?
Certainly want to report any loss of vision, whether it's sudden and total or just a little bit off. Typically, these sorts of medications will cause changes in one eye only, but doesn't mean that two can't be affected. And any dimming of color or a smudge in the vision or something like that might indicate that there is a change happening. The brain is really good at ignoring problems with the vision. It doesn't want to be bothered. It's, you know, it depends on the eyes to just do their job and be quiet. So most conditions of the eyes, outside of the things we're talking about today, most things don't let you know they're happening until it's pretty advanced. So an annual comprehensive eye exam with your optometrist is going to identify risks across a myriad of possibilities.
Is there a medication being developed to counter the potential symptoms that could result from taking GLP-1s?
One of the ways that we treat the bleeding and leaking of blood vessels in the retina in a diabetic or macular degeneration situation, we already have many medications to treat that. They involve injections into the eye. So certainly you don't want to get to that point, but if you do, thankfully we have some options. The swelling of the optic nerve, the more sudden one-sided loss of vision, you know, not a whole lot of medication options with that. There are other means of mediating that, but certainly it's an individual. You know, what happens with one person's vision may be very different from what happens with another's in terms of the outcome.
Is there any type of, what's the word that I'm looking for when two drugs interact and they cause a bad result? What is that?
Contraindications, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, your prescriber, the person who is prescribing the GLP-1 is certainly going to cover all those things and make sure, you know, that your thyroid cancer risk is low and that you don't have GI issues. But in addition to those two things that we've known for a long time about these medications, now that conversation needs to include the eye doctor.
What about eye allergies, though? I mean, if you're taking eye drops for eye allergies, would that have a contraindicated effect?
No, not necessarily. We haven't seen any concerns with regard to any topical medication that you're taking for the eyes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we are specifically looking for systemic issues.
Systemic issues that cause ocular issues. So certainly the eye, you know, the nerves and the blood vessels in the eye are linked throughout the body, but a swelling in a nerve elsewhere in your body would not necessarily result in a big disastrous loss of vision like swelling of the optic nerve might.
I think you
Again,
nailed it.
We're not recommending people... these are good medications. They have great effects. We're just encouraging people to include the eye exam in the ways that you're monitoring your health while you're taking these.
So all that glitters really isn't gold.
Right.
Right.
Well, it just bears awareness. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Any medication, yeah. You want to know your risks and know what's going on.
All right. So for our listeners who want to take a deeper dive into this subject, where's the best place for them to go for information?
Very easy to go to AOA's website. That's aoa.org/GLP-1. And there you'll find a pretty easy-to-digest article about what you might expect. And there will also be a link to help you find an eye doctor in your area that will take good care of you throughout the course of the medication treatment and beyond.
All right. We want to thank Dr. Jackie Bowen from the American Optometric Association. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
Governor Mike DeWine wasted little time in choosing the person to take over for Attorney General Dave Yost, who is stepping down from the post. Governor DeWine announced the appointment of Ohio Department of Public Safety Director Andy Wilson just 4 days after Dave Yost announced he's resigning in early June. Wilson will serve the final 7 months of Yost's term in office. The governor says it was important to make a quick decision in order to make a smooth transition.
Good morning, everybody.
Governor Mike DeWine walked through the door into his ceremonial office, trailed by the man he picked to be Attorney General, Ohio Department of Public Safety Director Andy Wilson.
I have a great deal of confidence in Andy Wilson.
Wilson says he will work to support law enforcement partners across the state and wake up every morning dedicated to serving the people of Ohio.
For the 7 months that I'm there, we're going to go 100 miles an hour, and we're going to lead with energy and passion.
DeWine appointed Wilson just 4 days after Attorney General Dave Yost announced he is taking the position of Vice President of Strategic Research and Innovation with the conservative nonprofit law firm Alliance Defending Freedom.
How important was it to you to make this happen quickly?
It was very important for me to make this decision quickly. The new Attorney General, frankly, has to start conversations today with the men and women in the Attorney General's office and certainly, you know, with the Attorney General.
In a statement, Yost said Governor DeWine's appointment of Andy Wilson is a wise selection to ensure that the mission of the office and the great progress we've made in the past 7+ years remains in steady hands. Wilson has served as director of the Ohio Department of Public Safety since December of 2022. Before that, he was Governor DeWine's senior advisor for criminal justice policy and Clark County prosecutor. In 2020, Wilson helped the Pike County Prosecutor's Office in the trial of 4 people accused of murdering 8 members of the Roden family in 2016. As for current cases the AG's office is handling, including the retrial in the First Energy bribery scandal, Wilson says he needs to talk to the staff.
I've learned through my career that trial prosecutors know the best about each and every case. I'm going to go through each and every case that they have, and I'm going to evaluate each and every case on its merits.
Yost's resignation is effective June 7th. Wilson will be sworn in at that time to serve the rest of Yost's term through December. Current Republican State Auditor Keith Faber and Democrat John Kulowitz are facing off for Attorney General in the November general election. Governor DeWine could have appointed Faber as Attorney General. He said he considered it, but chose not to. That could have led to a domino effect scenario of the governor appointing all the constitutional statewide officers less than 6 months from the election, all men who are running for those offices. Under that scenario, the governor could then have appointed Secretary of State Frank LaRose to Faber's auditor position, Treasurer Robert Sprague to replace LaRose as Secretary of State, and former State Representative Jay Edwards to replace Sprague as treasurer. The governor explained why he decided not to do this.
But frankly, when I thought about that, It just seemed not the right thing to do. You know, I have great confidence that Keith Faber will be a very, very, very good Attorney General, and I support him for that. And it you know, his election, I think, is essential. But the idea of appointing one or maybe all of the statewide office holders, which was certainly a distinct possibility, and certainly was an option, just didn't seem right to me. We have an election coming. We're only six months away from the election. For me to step in as governor and appoint literally every single statewide office holder just didn't look right to me, didn't seem right to me, didn't seem like something that I should do.
The next disaster is coming. The time to get ready is now. Make a plan. Choose meetup locations and keep a contact list. Build a kit with food and water. Don't forget your pets. Keep extra medicine on hand. Make copies of key documents and keep them somewhere safe. Stay informed, learn about local hazards, and sign up for alerts. Be ready. Learn more at americares.org/sendusin.
And the day after being appointed Attorney General, Wilson was in the news for a different reason. He's accused of interfering in a criminal case. Wilson is named in a Delaware County court case involving a semi-truck driver accused in a deadly I-71 crash last month. Modu Nagom is charged with aggravated vehicular homicide. The crash killed the Sapowski family. Seen here, one of the victims was just 1 year old. Now the attorney representing Nagom is asking the judge to dismiss the case. The attorney claims statements Wilson made to the media in his role as public safety director stripped his client of his right to a fair trial. 10TV's Kevin Landers talked to Wilson about the attorney's claims. Wilson was unapologetic about the comments he made, saying it's his job as public safety director to be transparent about information regarding the trucker's past.
Morning, everybody.
24 hours after his appointment by Governor Mike DeWine as Attorney General for Ohio, which takes effect in June, Andy Wilson is making news this time for what he said as the Director of Public Safety. This motion, filed on April 28th in Delaware County Common Pleas Court, names Wilson and accuses him of stripping the rights to a fair trial of a truck driver who was charged with the deaths of a Delaware County family after investigators say his semi rear-ended them last month. The motion asked the judge to dismiss the indictment. The attorney for the driver, Modu Nagom, says Wilson's statements about his prior criminal activity was, quote, a deliberate action taken by a cabinet-level official to actively promote the public dissemination of derogatory information to smear defendant who was awaiting trial and, quote, unfairly tainted public perception of Mr. Nagom that he cannot be given a fair trial. We approached Wilson at a public event to get his reaction.
We had discovered some things about the driver's background and his licenses. And in transparency, we wanted the public to know that that was going on. So the governor's office, actually through public safety, we issued a statement just letting the public know what we had found out about this driver. It doesn't affect his case.
No regrets about making those comments?
No, we have a duty to keep the public informed.
According to the Department of Public Safety, the truck driver fraudulently obtained a new Ohio driver's license around 2003 and later a commercial driver's license in 2007 under an alternate identity. He faces 3 counts of aggravated vehicular homicide and 4 counts of vehicular assault, all felonies.
And that was Kevin Landers reporting. Kevin spoke to the prosecutor's office, who says they plan to file a response to the motion to dismiss. No word as of the taping of Face the State on when a judge will make a decision on the motion. Ohio Senator Bernie Moreno scored a unanimous victory in banning senators from using prediction markets. His resolution passed the Senate by unanimous consent. Moreno says the measure prohibits senators, officers, and staff from entering any financial deal where the outcome depends on whether a specific event does or does not happen. I talked with Senator Moreno by phone while he was in the Senate TV studio. I asked why he feels this resolution is necessary.
Well, Doug, let's be honest. The approval rating for Congress is somewhere above Jeffrey Dahmer levels. So this is about rebuilding faith in this institution. And we can't do it all at once. We got to build this brick by brick. And this is just one more piece of it. You don't want voters thinking that instead of spending time focused on the issues that they care about, that we're on some sort of prediction market making bets on inside information. Now, by the way, very proud of the fact that we got that done. 100 senators voted for that. So that's also in effect now. So it's done. It's completed. The next step is to ban the trading of stocks. That's something that is long overdue. I, as you know, sold all of my individual stocks. Don't have any of that. Sold all my operating businesses. And we need, it's long overdue for members of Congress not to trade stocks. Certainly not when there's any kind of conflict of interest in what they do.
So does the resolution have teeth, or is it more of a symbolic gesture to get people on record that they won't do it?
Oh, it has absolute teeth. In fact, I can tell you that if somebody is on the first of all, that happened is all the prediction companies deleted all the accounts of any member of Congress and staff. So that's already happened. Now, if they try to log back in doing some sort of pseudonym or whatever, they will get referred to the ethics committee. The ethics committee can refer that senator to the Department of Justice, and that would be the end of that senator's political career or that staffer's career. So it absolutely has teeth.
The resolution changes the standing rules of the Senate.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM, 97.1 The Fan, and on 1460 AM, The Fan 2.